Welcome to Wrestling with Theology. My name is Doug Minton. I am your host. I am the pastor at Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church in Robbinsdale, Minnesota, as well as a lifelong wrestling fan. Wrestling with Theology wrestles with the history of pro wrestling as well as the theology of the Lutheran Church. This week's wrestling profile is Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert. Eddie Gilbert grew up in Lexington, Tennessee, about an hour northeast of Memphis. Most of his success came in Memphis wrestling. His biggest feuds were against Jerry Lawler. What I didn't know during his life, that he was also one of the greatest wrestling bookers of the late 80s and 90s. He was well known as a great heel who would do about anything for his valet slash wife, Missy Hyatt. Eddie is the oldest son of Tommy Gilbert, a legend in Southern wrestling. Growing up in Tennessee, Eddie was a great fan of wrestling, especially Jerry Lawler. He was fascinated by the idea and the success Lawler had of wrestling and booking at the same time. Eddie began wrestling in 79 as Tommy Gilbert Jr., but he started going by his real name once he made it over to the WWF as enhancement talent. He wrestled in the WWF from 82 to 84, being sidelined for a few months by a car accident in 83. Vince saw promise in Eddie, but Eddie wanted to be closer to home. He began wrestling primarily in Memphis in late 84, where he teamed with his father, Ricky Morton, and Tommy Rich. Gilbert and Rich were named Fargo's Fabulous Ones as a rip against the Fabulous Ones, Steve Kern and Stan Lane. After Gilbert and Rich broke up, they began a brief yet intense feud over the CWA International Heavyweight title. During the feud, the duo was awarded Tag Team of the Year for the previous year. The altercation around the award presentation actually ended the feud as Gilbert left Memphis to go to Mid-South. In 86, while wrestling and booking for Bill Watts' Universal Wrestling Federation, Eddie added the Hot Stuff nickname. He began a heel stable with Sting, Ultimate Warrior, and Rick Steiner as Hot Stuff International. He stole Missy Hyatt from Hollywood John Tatum, and she came alongside the stable as their manager in 87. Gilbert and Hyatt were married in 88. Iceman King Parsons and Dick Murdoch would also spend time in H&H International. During his time with the UWF, Eddie's best storyline was the Battle of New Orleans in late 87, involving himself, Chris Adams, Terry Taylor, and Sting. The ensuing brawl went all over the arena and earned Eddie Wrestling Observer Newsletter's Booker of the Year in 88. When Jim Crockett Promotions bought UWF, Eddie had a tag team feud with Sting against Kevin Sullivan's Varsity Club. He was also in a brief feud with Ric Flair and Barry Windham, where he teamed with Ricky Steamboat and Lex Luger. About the time Ted Turner bought Jim Crockett Promotions, Eddie's contract was up. He left WCW and divorced Missy. He went back to Memphis to book for the USWA. He was also one of the masterminds behind Global Wrestling Federation. He was also a booker for Tri-State Wrestling Association, where he met and married Medusa Michelli. They were divorced shortly after. His most famous feud in Memphis, as I said, was with Jerry Lawler. Of course, anyone who came to Memphis ended up feuding with Lawler at some point or another. The most infamous incident of this feud involved Eddie hitting Lawler with a car in the studio's parking lot. Since it was broadcast on live TV, many people called into the Memphis Police Department to report the crime. Lawler had to explain the angle to the police and appear on television almost immediately so that Gilbert wouldn't get arrested. After leaving Global Wrestling Federation in 92, Eddie and his brother Doug went to NWA's Eastern Championship Wrestling, which would become Extreme Championship Wrestling. Eddie served as the head booker until he handed over the reins to Paul Heyman in September of 93. He returned to Memphis, where he wrestled and booked until early 95. He moved to Puerto Rico to wrestle and book for Carlos Colon's World Wrestling Council. He died of a heart attack on February 18, 95, in Puerto Rico. His last recorded match is supposed to be November 19th of 94, where he was in the NWA World Heavyweight Title Tournament, which was won by Chris Candido. Apparently, none of his matches after that, in the 3 months in between that tournament and his death, were ever recorded on video and released.
Eddie was a talented wrestler, even though he gave himself several of his titles. He held the NWA Central States Tag Team title with Ricky Romero. He was the AWA Southern Heavyweight Champion, 4-time AWA Southern Tag Team Champion, 2-time CWA International Heavyweight title, ECW Tag Team Champion with his brother Doug as the Dark Patriot, Global Wrestling Federation North American Heavyweight Champion, 2-time GWF Television Champion, U.S. Tag Team Champion with Rick Steiner, Mid-South Tag Team Champion with the Nightmare, 3-time Tri-State Tag Team Champion, 2-time UWF World Tag Team Champion with Sting. Once he held the UWF World Television title, he held the USWA Heavyweight title, the USWA Southern Heavyweight title, the USWA Tag Team title with Brian Christopher. 4 times he held the USWA Unified World Heavyweight title. And then early on in his career, he and his father held the World Wrestling Council North American Tag Team titles. Overall, Eddie is ranked number 83 of all time by PWI. Eddie was a consummate professional in the ring. He took his usual role as a heel very well. While I grew up in Memphis, I believe his best work was in UWF Missy, Sting, and Steiner. They were a great stable to watch, but I am adding the link to Gilbert's final match in that NWA World Title Tournament into the episode comments to have that be seen as one of his great matches. I'll be back in a moment with digging deeper into Exodus 5 and 6. Back with digging deeper, looking at Exodus chapters 5 and 6. This is where the rubber begins to meet the road with the children of Israel in Egypt, where now that Moses is coming in and saying, "Let my people go," Pharaoh says, "No, you can't go. And therefore, I'm going to make sure that I make life a living hell for your people." So we have chapter 5, where Pharaoh requires them to make the same amount of bricks as beforehand, but he's not providing the straw anymore for them. And then chapter 6, God promises deliverance even in the midst of this hardened ruler. So we look at Exodus chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. "Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness.' But Pharaoh said, 'Who is the Lord, that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go.' Then they said, 'The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword.' But the king of Egypt said to them, 'Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens.' And Pharaoh said, 'Behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens. The same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the number of bricks that they make in the past you shall impose on them. You shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry, 'Let us go and offer sacrifice to our God.' Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it and pay no regard to lying words." This is one of those places where we get the idea of idle hands being the devil's playground. This is what Pharaoh thinks. Oh, they want to go out because they're lazy. They want to get out of work. They don't want to do what the Egyptian gods have caused them to do as slaves of the Egyptians. So he increases the heat of the work that they have to do. He says, make the same number of bricks. That doesn't change, but you have to find your own straw. I'm not going to supply it anymore. You have to work even harder because you want to be left out. You want to be catered to. And that is something that slaves do not do. So we continue in verse 10. So the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out and said to the people, "Thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get your straw yourselves wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced in the least." So the people were scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, "Complete your work, your daily task each day, as when there was straw." And the foremen of the people of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, "Why have you not done all your task of making bricks today and yesterday, as in the past?" Then the foremen of the people of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, "Why do you treat your servants like this? No straw is given to your servants, yet you say to us, 'Make bricks.' And behold, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." But he said, "You were idle, you were idle. That is why you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Go now and work. No straw will be given you, but you must still deliver the same number of bricks." The foremen of the people of Israel saw that they were in trouble when they said, "You shall by no means reduce your number of bricks, your daily task each day." They met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh. And they said to them, "The Lord look on you and judge, because you have made a stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." Isn't this the way it always goes? One thing happens, and you have to find somebody to blame. Pharaoh blames the foreman for allowing the people to be idle and lazy. The foreman blame Moses and Aaron for causing all of this trouble. We go back to Genesis chapter 3, and we see the same thing with Adam. You know, "God, it was the woman you gave me." You know, Eve said, "It was the serpent who deceived me." Everybody wants to pass the buck. So even the foreman, after being beaten by the taskmasters, want to blame Moses and Aaron for meddling in Pharaoh's business. So then this is one of many times Moses prays to the Lord in a very solemn way. Verse 22, then Moses turned to the Lord and said, "O Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all." The rubber meets the road. "God, you brought me in here to deliver this people, and you're making it even worse." And that's the way God works sometimes. Sometimes he makes it to where it gets even worse before he makes it better. It's all about making the deliverance look better. That you truly understand the deliverance you are given if you have that rock bottom experience. And that's why testimonies in evangelical churches are so wonderful. Because they talk about being the worst of the worst. The heroin addicted prostitute who had crack baby after crack baby just to keep her addiction going, but now has found Jesus. And it seems like everything has to try to top something like that. But God uses even the worst of the situations that we are in to bring about his deliverance. And that's what he tells Moses in chapter 6. "But the Lord said to Moses, 'Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will send them out, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land. God says, Pharaoh says no now, but there will come a time where he will chase you out of the land of Egypt. He will want nothing more than to get rid of you. And that's exactly what happens in the Exodus. But we have to go through the steps to get to the Exodus. We have to get to the point where Egypt has hit rock bottom in God's wrath. Chapter 6, verse 2. God spoke to Moses and said to him, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty. But by my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they lived as sojourners. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the people of Israel, whom the Egyptians hold as slaves, and I have remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will deliver you out of slavery to them. And I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you for a possession. I am the Lord. Moses spoke thus to the people of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses because of their broken spirit and harsh slavery. Here, God gives Moses the complete promise, the gospel promise of deliverance, of the remembrance of the covenant, the gaining of a land that had been promised to their forefathers. And when Moses delivers that message to the people want nothing to do with it. And that is the problem. People don't want to hear the message because they have a broken spirit. They are in harsh slavery to their sin. So people don't want to hear the good news when there is bad going on. And this is the Israelites at this moment as Moses is trying to convince them that God will bring them out of this. There will be an end in sight. But it's just a little bit further down the road. So they don't listen. Verse 10, so the Lord said to Moses, go in, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the people of Israel go out of his land. But Moses said to the Lord, behold, the people of Israel have not listened to me. How then shall Pharaoh listen to me? For I am of uncircumcised lips. But the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and gave them a charge about the people of Israel and about Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt. When God says do something, you do it. You don't ask questions. That's Moses' big problem, is he keeps asking questions. He keeps wanting to know how and why and all of this. And it's questions that will not be answered because God doesn't answer how and why questions very often. But he does answer with deliverance. As we move into verse 14 of chapter 6, we get into the genealogy of Moses and Aaron. And so we have, these are the heads of their fathers' houses, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. These are the clans of Reuben. The sons of Simeon, Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. These are the clans of Simeon. These are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari, the years of the life of Levi being 137 years. The sons of Gershon, Libni and Shimei by their clans, the sons of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uzziel, the years of the life of Kohath being 133 years. The sons of Merari, Mahli, and Mushi, these are the clans of the Levites according to their generations. Amram took as his wife Jochebed, his father's sister, and she bore him Aaron and Moses, the years of the life of Amram being 137 years. The sons of Izhar, Korah, Nepheg, and Zikri, the sons of Uzziel, Mishael, Elzaphan, and Sithri. Aaron took as his wife Elisheba, the daughter of Amminadab and the sister of Nashon, and she bore him Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. The sons of Korah, Asir, Elkanah, and Abisath. These are the clans of the Korahites. Eleazar, Aaron's son, took as his wife one of the daughters of Putiel, and she bore him Phinehas. These are the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites by their clans. Lots of names. Lots of things going on to focus in on where this is coming from, where Moses and Aaron fit into the people of Israel as God is getting us down to boiling down the firstborn that is to be set apart from every family down to just the Levites as the priest. So we have all of those things. Verse 26, these are the Aaron and Moses to whom the Lord said, bring out the people of Israel from the land of Egypt by their host. It was they who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, about bringing out the people of Israel from Egypt, this Moses and this Aaron. On the day when the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, the Lord said to Moses, I am the Lord. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. But Moses said to the Lord, behold, I am of uncircumcised lips. How will Pharaoh listen to me? The same question he asked in verse 12. He asks in verse 30, how is Pharaoh going to listen to me? God's answer, the 10 plagues. If Pharaoh won't listen to words, let him listen and see with his eyes what the Lord is doing in his time and in his face. And we'll pick up with that next time we come to digging deeper as we start the plagues in Exodus chapter 7. Thank you for your time and listening to this podcast. If you'd like to hear more, go back to our archives to hear the previous episodes of Wrestling with Theology. Also hear Sunday morning sermons from Redeemer. If you are in the Twin Cities area on Sunday morning, you are welcome to join us at Redeemer Evangelical Lutheran Church at 4201 Regent Avenue North in Robbinsdale, just off of the corner of 42nd Avenue and Highway 100. Just look for Jesus blessing the travelers along the road. Our services are at 9 a.m. We have Bible study at 10:30 following the service, with coffee hour in between. We encourage you, anytime you are in the area, to join us for worship and to wrestle with theology with us.